IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. New rules that have come out about social media regulation in India have some pretty serious implications for privacy, for data collection by social media giants. And most importantly, a second-hand effect, they could have some pretty serious implications for things that you and I do on social media. The day is theoretically not far where somebody who puts out a WhatsApp forward, no matter how well-intentioned, could potentially have it traced back to them and face legal consequences for it. Now, in practice, given that WhatsApp has become a repository of misinformation and so on, it might seem like a good idea, but rules like this cannot be read away from the context within which they're coming out. And given the recent trend that we've seen over the last few months of the way that the government has kind of been using its powers to silence criticism of things that haven't been going well for it, it could potentially have some very serious ramifications for individual liberty and for freedom of the press and a whole bunch of other things that are so fundamental to the ideals of the Indian Constitution. But before we get into all these potential implications, let's first try to understand what exactly these rules are saying. So Rohan, over to you. Can you first help us understand what these rules are saying and what kind of immediate first-order ramifications they may have for social media giants and for the users?
Hey, thanks. Bunch of things, actually. Let me try to answer your question with a little bit of an anecdote. So the draft for these rules came out back in 2018. And ever since then, there has been a lot of anticipation around just tech policy circles in Delhi around when this thing is going to be finalized. And I remember being vaguely concerned about the draft at the time in 2018. And because the draft basically said that if you're a social media company that has over 50 lakh users, correct me if I'm wrong, Kritik, I don't remember the threshold now, but if you have above a certain number of users, then you need to have a grievance officer stationed in India that the government can reach out to. You need to take down content if it violates public order and a bunch of other things. I think at some point, the rules also said that if the content is blasphemous, you need to take it down, but you will have to confirm. And because generally, content moderation was going to change. And I remember thinking this is extremely serious because it also said that we need to find out where the origin of particular messages is coming from. And so we would need you to give us that information when we ask for it. That's what the government was saying to these intermediaries. And intermediaries, of course, are platforms and other things that are sort of intermediate. They play an intermediate role in your connection to the internet and so on and to communication. And the encryption thing really struck everyone in tech policy circles, and they kept on talking about it until donkey's ears. And I thought this is the worst possible version of these rules that we could have. And I kept saying it in different op-eds for the last 3 years. And lo and behold, this time, finally, we have these rules. And they're not just looking at intermediaries, they're also looking at news channels and content creators and trying to have a different version of a censor board. I mean, not exactly a censor board, just a different version of censorship that is different from a censor board. It's going to have a censorship mechanism for OTTs. And it's basically setting up a big disincentive to have any edgy content on the internet. And so basically what this is, it's new rules for how social media companies have to operate, on how these OTT players that are, I mean, including Faye D'Souza or Dhruv Rathi or whoever, also these streaming services and what they can put up online. So that's basically where we are at. If you want to read the full rules or analysis of them, we can put some links in the show notes. But that basically it's how companies on the internet are supposed to function and how to deal with content that is not something that the government likes. Yeah.
If I can add to that, right? As Rohan mentioned, there are essentially two parts to these rules. One concerns your intermediaries, which is, you know, basically anything from a cyber cafe to Facebook that sits between you and the internet. Now, cyber cafe is, of course, not directly named anywhere in these specific rules themselves. But the interesting thing to note is that they've also carved out a separate classification for social media intermediaries, right? And within that, anything above 5 million users classifies as a significant social media intermediaries, in which where they've enlisted a bunch of additional obligations on them, where they need to have a chief compliance officer in the country, they need to have a grievance officer who's in the country, and you know, and also pertaining to automated moderation or automated takedown of content. Right now, these have serious implications as well. And as you mentioned, Anirudh, it's important to look at these in the context of the scenario in which they've been rolled out as well. Right, and on the other side of it, which is, as Rohan mentioned, the news publishers and the online curated content platforms, they've also instituted a three-tier mechanism of oversight, right? Which is, the first is a grievance officer at each platform level. Then there's call for a self-regulatory organization. And right on top, there is what's been referred to as a soft touch mechanism, but it's essentially a judgment by the executive that will play an oversight role in this scenario, right? So there are significant implications that these rules will put into place.
So there's really so much to get into, but let's try to take this one by one, right? So let's begin at the beginning, and let's talk first about how intermediaries are affected by these new rules. You said that everyone from a social media giant to a cyber cafe is potentially affected. What does that really mean in practice? Does that mean that, let's say that I go to a cyber cafe because, I don't know, the internet in my house isn't working, and I tweet out something, and somebody or the other in the government has a problem with what I've tweeted for whatever reason. Does that mean that they can arm twist the cyber cafe into revealing my details?
As far as I know, that's technically already in place, right? Cyber cafes are required to maintain a strict log of who uses these services, etc. So I think to a large extent, that's already in place. I don't know, Rohan, if you think differently.
No. My thing is, yes, the government can arm twist cyber cafes. I mean, they didn't need these rules to arm twist cyber cafes in the first place. But my point is that not all intermediaries are equal. So a cyber cafe has less power than Facebook. And a cyber cafe also may not have the information that the government's looking for. So yes, the government can arm twist a bunch of people ranging from cyber cafes to data cloud computing providers to these platforms. Yes, but how they are going to affect these social media companies, I think it's quite something. So, I mean, I want to look at a few use cases first, but let me, and this is going to be a bit of a rant, but so...
Yeah, go ahead. I think a rant is the very least that these wonderful rules deserve at this point.
No, it begins with me sitting in this conference that we were having in New Delhi about these rules, and we are getting into... So the conference at the time is getting into the weeds of what these rules are going to do. And my basic question to any of this is that how does the government decide how to enforce this 5 million user threshold, right? Because, for example, apps don't come up in app stores asking for the government's regulation. I don't know if this is 5 million registered users, daily active users, monthly users. And I don't know how does the government know that an app has crossed 5 million users? There is just, apps don't reveal these figures to governments on their own volition. So is that something they have to do now, right? It's very weird. And so my only possible explanation for this is that this looks like a nice number. The government said, listen, if you have 5 million users, you're pretty big. And so they're not going to actually monitor every intermediary that has 5 million users. Instead, they're just going to maybe look at Twitter, Facebook, and maybe sometime in a distant future, Clubhouse. But, I mean, this is fairly ambiguous just at the beginning. Going forward, how does this affect people that have over 5 million users? So the thing here is that they're saying you should have a grievance officer, right? Which is good. I mean, objectively, if you just look at that, a grievance officer is not an absolutely terrible idea, right? At the same time, you've got to imagine that, let's say there's a video recording that's happening on YouTube Live, right? And something that was said triggers a certain faction of people who belong to some political sentiments and so on. And so now, so for example, if there's a newscaster like Faye D'Souza and she has a team of 4 people, then one of them has to be a grievance officer. So can you imagine the sheer number of random things that are going to come up to that team? And none of this is going to be checked and balanced because it can be just some random person who just believes that this particular thing has triggered them. And similarly for breaking end-to-end encryption, I think Nikhil Pava was on a TV interview and he basically said, listen, requiring traceability of where these messages are coming from is going to require platforms to re-architect how they were created, and which is not something I'm comfortable with. Why should governments tell companies how these platforms should be architected, right? Is there now just one single mode of platform architecture that's acceptable in India? I don't know. And the other thing here is that, I mean, use case wise, it makes sense if you've got from WhatsApp to WhatsApp something that, let's say Prateek and I are joking, right? And we are making fun of Anirudh. It's perfectly acceptable because I think it's in good fun and we don't mean him harm. But if...
No, I'm going to call the grievance officer, man. This is unacceptable. You can't...
But that's my point. See, if for me and Prateek, this is not actually something that's unacceptable behavior. But if you read that conversation, then it's going to be harmful to you. That's how just information works. People don't consume it in an objective environment. Okay, it's consuming it is subjective. So something that's playful to us can be damaging to you. And that's why these things can be filed. And for example, there's a WhatsApp forward that I made in jest and now has caused something completely different that I didn't intend to. Am I to be held responsible? And for that to happen, does WhatsApp need to completely re-architect its platform? And imagine if it's not just on WhatsApp, but if I am actually typing out something on WhatsApp and sharing it on, let's say, Twitter, or I'm sharing it on Signal, if it's cross-platform, then what is the protocol there? Because then do all platforms need to have this common thing where one platform can tell the other platform where the message came from? I mean, to me, it's all a bit bonkers. It's ambiguous and purposefully so. And I feel like this should be challenged in court because at the very starting point of this, the IT Act didn't mean to cover any of this. So it's just, I mean, sorry about the long rant, but there's just so much that needs to be just reformed and how this is being carried out. I think we can discuss other implications later, but this just makes a massive disincentive for any social media companies or news organizations or just people who are doing independent news reporting. It makes a massive disincentive to have anything edgy on there. And when I mean edgy, it's in the most subjective sense because you just got to be, I don't know how else to say this, but you...
Anything other than the most safe and bland and inoffensive content is now potentially going to come with massive financial and legal implications.
Yep.
And so there's an incentive for all these platforms to basically ensure that there's, how do I put this, that the discourse on their platforms is as inoffensive, pro-government, and mediocre as possible. And thank you. I mean, actually, thank you for this rant, Rohan, because I think you've covered a lot of very, very significant points very eloquently. The first and foremost being that where on earth is the legal basis for any of this? The IT Act, as you said, was not designed for the kind of world of IT that we see today. And yet these rules are supposed to be acting in accordance with that. They're potentially illegal. I have no idea how on earth they've already been implemented. And that shouldn't be happening. And also, thank you for the perspective on how platforms have to be fundamentally retooled. I can imagine there must be absolute panic in a lot of these places right now, because if you don't comply with them, then the penalties to you are going to be massive. And by saying that businesses can only perform a certain way in India, then you're basically holding back not just content on existing platforms, but you're also holding back new platforms from innovating. And I find that to be rather ironic coming from a dispensation that claims to be pro-innovation and wants to use IT to help power India's growth. And I think the single biggest takeaway from this entire thing was that it has clearly not been thought through from the perspective of actual users and people who are actually going to be implementing this. It's been thought through totally from the perspective of what is convenient to the government and the enforcing apparatus. And that is absolutely the wrong perspective to go about thinking about any kind of legislation that could potentially impact so many millions of people across India and potentially fundamentally change the way that citizens have discourse in the 21st century. That's something that is seriously concerning. And it'd be like saying that public gatherings are no longer allowed, or you are no longer allowed to talk to your friends without somebody from the government being able to listen in to you and trace back to you what you're allowed to say. In no democratic country where we have Supreme Court judgments protecting the right to privacy, can rules like this be in any way tenable? You are fundamentally changing the public sphere itself. And there are major, major implications to that. You said that the rules are ambiguous and that is deliberate. And yes, of course, they're deliberately ambiguous. It's meant to give some faceless bureaucrat sitting in some faceless government building in Delhi absolute power to control what you say on social media. And for those who might think that because it's a political dispensation that they're in favor of, it's okay, it is really not, because Indian governments, no matter what the particular ruling party is, have a well-established track record of using whatever tools they have, and some tools that they also don't legally have, to prosecute those who disagree with them. So if the tables were turned, if it was the other major political party of India in control of this apparatus, would we be okay with them controlling what we say on social media to this extent? I don't think so. And I think for that reason alone, we should be very, very concerned about what kind of implications these rules are going to have. Now, so Rohan, you've talked a lot about how these impact platforms, the big fish in this entire game, as it were. But I'm actually very concerned about the impact it might have on activists. We know in great and rather painful detail how various state governments, even municipal governments, have gone out of their way to prosecute whistleblowers, to prosecute activists, and you know, often do so in absolutely horrific and extrajudicial ways. As a result of that, a lot of people who are activists on Twitter and on social media do so anonymously, with the whole idea being that they are anonymously able to speak truth to power while not being at the receiving end of the Indian state's brutality. Now you're basically coming to a situation where for shedding light on, let's say, corruption, for shedding light on, let's say, police abusing their power, or for shedding light on, let's say, some bureaucrat accepting money to let some kind of dangerous project goes through that pollutes groundwater and kills children, the government can trace you down, can track you down, and unleash its brutality on you. So all in all, these are very, very concerning and very worrying developments. And I don't think there's any way to water it down. I know that every week we tend to talk about disturbing new things happening in tech, but this really takes the cake in all the time that we've been doing these episodes. But let me pause my rant here. And Pratik, do you have any thoughts, any comments on potential implications, what might happen going forward?
I think Rohan's made a couple of good points about whether these can potentially be challenged in court or not. Your point about the verification of users is also interesting, right? At this point, it's positioned as a voluntary mechanism, but we've seen how there is a tendency for something that's instituted as voluntary to then become mandatory or enforced in some way, shape, or form, right? And there is, it plays into this whole line of thought, which I've seen very often, that hey, if we end anonymity, we're going to end all our information ecosystem problems, right? And I think it leaves me shaking my head vigorously when I read such views, because there is absolutely nothing to say that just because you end anonymous accounts, all sorts of misinformation, disinformation is going to stop, because as we've seen, a lot of them happen to be verified named accounts, named people who go out and spread propaganda, information, etc., for their own political ends, right? So there is this misconception that's now finding its way into legislation or into executive action. There's a couple of other interesting points. I know we said a lot of negative things about it, but there's a couple of interesting things as well in terms of the requirement for transparency reports, right? I think that's something that is interesting, in the sense that this is something that I think Rohan and me have argued for, have spoken about very often, that platforms typically tend to dump data on us from a very North American, Western European perspective, and it's very hard to tell what's happening from in countries like India, right? I think some sort of push to, at this point, this pertains to the grievance redressal mechanism, right? But if there is something that pushes them to release more data in terms of how they're enforcing their policies in India, I think that can be a long-term positive development. Keeping in mind, very importantly, that there is also the very real chance of weaponization of transparency, in the sense that there will be so much information that you won't know what to do with it, how to analyze it, how to parse it, right? So there are those smaller things that we should also be paying attention to in these rules, right? We've spoken a lot about the broad strokes implications, but there are, as with any rules, there are also minor points that we need to look at and make sure they don't get lost in the din as well.
No, fair enough. In terms of actually analyzing all this information and systematically shaping the media ecosystem, I don't necessarily think the government can do that. My bigger concern is of them making examples.
Yeah.
And those examples basically being used to kind of terrify people into not doing things. I mean, very obviously, the case that has been filed against the makers of Tandav is meant to do some chest thumping about not offending a particular religion, for example. Or the arrest of an activist for editing a Google Doc is, again, it seems to me, rather than being based on a deep analysis of facts, the bail order itself reveals that the police really cut some corners. And why would they do that? It seems to me, again, that it's a sign.
And that's a very good point. So, we were speaking about the traceability requirements, right? And the rules themselves specifically say that there is, I guess, in quotes, an inbuilt safeguard where this, you know, it can be used when the imprisonment for the crime is more than 5 years. But that presupposes that there is never overreach on that front, right? That sections of the IPC in charge sheets are applied very judiciously.
Exactly.
Which we've seen is not really always the case, right?
And also, the way that it's framed is that it's, heinous crimes of like more than, that deserve more than 5 years of punishments, such as that there were like two or three examples given, like I think treason against India's sovereignty, whatnot. And then there was an etc. And I feel that etc. is far more telling than anything else that's actually in the bill, because it gives so much leeway for some jumped up bureaucrat who has taken it upon himself to prove to his overlords that he's a very he's an aggressive go getter to basically go and prosecute whoever he sees fit, and that is a matter of concern in my point of view.
Yeah, and there's another important point that we haven't touched on, which I think is pertaining to the regulation of digital news media. Right, there is a question mark on how this is going to apply to international news outlets. Right, there was actually a question on this front in the press conference. If you look up the video, it's the last question that came in. And the answer was sort of open-ended in the sense that, look, we've asked for grievance redressal mechanism. Then if you think you can sit in the US and show content in India, then that's not right. So it's I've seen this in a couple of articles about the rules as well, right? So it's really an open question at this stage in terms of how these rules can be used against international news outlets, which we've seen right now are tending towards being critical of a lot of the moves that the government is making. And I think that's a space to watch out for in terms of how that's going to play out, right? So again, this is not necessarily saying that we're going to go and block the New York Times tomorrow, but I think it's going to be important to watch how we react or how the government reacts to continued or sustained criticism from international news outlets.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Like we alluded to in the beginning of this conversation, you cannot divorce anything the government is doing now from the political context within which they're occurring. And I think the fact that they're coming just as we're seeing a whole bunch of criticism, in my view, justified about various things, that we're seeing these rules come out is extremely significant. But yeah, it is going to be curious to see what kind of pushback, if any, there is, given what Owen was saying about how fundamentally these change the way that platforms do things. What kind of pushback do you guys anticipate?
Hey, just a couple of things I want to add before the pushback. So first thing is, when you talked about the stuff that said sovereignty and friendly relations with other states, etc., it's not just the etc. that's troubling me, because it also talks about public order as something that can be used as a rationale to basically trigger some of the other contents in this new notification, which is public order is essentially different from criminality, right? But what exactly is public order? I mean, do protests come under a part of public order? Because I mean, it's subjective, right? It's a much broader term, and I think it's going to be pretty damaging and also going to be hard to justify what is and isn't public order. I mean, I see a lot more edge cases coming, which is going to lead to a lot of problems in the future. But let's hope that's not prophetic. The other thing I wanted to talk to you guys about was the problem statement. Because, I mean, generally, we do this in our courses at Takshashila. This is a humble plug, but I'm going to do it anyway. But the thing here is, generally policies are put in place to address a problem, right? There is regulation that is proactive, there is regulation that is reactive. It's not clear to me exactly what the problem statement is here. What is it that these guidelines are trying to fix? And because the point is that if there is a problem that has been identified, then we can look at whether breaking encryption is the way to go about this, or whether there are other places in the stack that we can actually look at modifying and getting to what we actually want. Similarly, I'm just not sure what the government is trying to fix, why are they going about it this way. And generally, I would love it if there was a white paper that, and this is maybe just me being extremely optimistic, but I just don't understand how a white paper could harm this particular debate as of right now, because there's so much pushback. If there was a white paper that told us this is the problem, this is why we are using this thing, and they should fix it. For example, the RBI, when they came up with localization norms, said, I mean, it wasn't exactly a white paper as long as it was two paragraphs. But the key thing there was, we want unfettered supervisory access to the financial data because it's a sensitive thing. I mean, I could see that yes, this is maybe not the best way of fixing the problem, but at least I knew what the problem was. Here I am just dumbfounded as to what the problem statement is and why we are using these things to these extremely drastic measures to go about fixing this. I mean, I'm so lost and also like so concerned. So yeah. On the pushback thing, I think there's going to be a lot, and I think Pratik can add to this. But generally, I think most of these big companies that make edgy content, and when I say edgy, I mean stuff like Sacred Games or, I don't know, Tandav for sure. But there's going to be pushback. I mean, I feel like a lot of big companies are going to take the government to court regarding this. I'd be surprised if that didn't happen. And I'd love to see what a judge has to say about this and how they weigh in on this. But I think we are in for some very problematic battles for the future of India's internet. And I think that clock starts ticking now. Yeah, so yeah.
I'm actually not as optimistic as Rohan in terms of pushback right now. I think it was DigiPub that came out and criticized the rules in a letter to Prakash Javadekar. But in general, right, I don't see anyone taking too much of an adversarial stance to these rules, at least not organizationally. They might say that, okay, we have problems with this part of the rules, but in general, we welcome the rules. Right? Those are the sort of vacuous statements we've been getting so far. While we're discussing these rules being challenged in court, that hasn't happened yet. It may happen, but I doubt that's going to come from one of the larger tech companies. I suspect that's probably going to be a PIL by an activist exposing themselves to risk in some way or the other. So I don't unfortunately share Rohan's optimism in terms of how much of a pushback there is going to be.
Can you just let me have this, man? Just please.
I also wish I'm not sure I share the confusion about what exactly these rules are meant to do. Clearly, from a policy perspective, there is no actual clear policy problem that they're meant to tackle. But in terms of publicity, PR, government image, I think the motivation behind these rules is actually staring us in the face, which is always a sad day for it's always a sad day for any democracy when you have to rely on the courage of activists to hold the government to account. Let's hope, as always, we can only hope that things will turn out better than we inevitably predict them to. But yeah, that I hope that that gives all of you, all of our listeners, a better sense of what exactly these new rules might lead to and what they might hold in future, if not immediately, at least in the years and decades perhaps to come, how they will shape the conversations on India by Indians and by the rest of the world. Let's hope that a generation from now, we don't see this moment as a turning point in a negative sense of the word. On that note, thank you both, Rohan and Pratik, for joining me.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, If you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle at TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.
Hey, hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.